I am Hunter. Welcome to the I Am Hunter podcast. I'm Rod, and I'll be chatting to a mate of mine called Nath today. We're going to discuss a few issues going on in the hunting industry at the moment, and we're also going to talk about access to farms, what it's like when you gain access, and what things you're going to face taking part in the access that you have to the farms. I might add that we recorded this one while we were driving in the car, so the sound's not that flash, but here we go.
How did you end up getting access to this property? Was it through mates, or did you know someone already?
They put an ad in a deer magazine.
Yeah.
And we were just in the process of leaving one property.
Is this Penstock?
No, we were hunting up at Silver Plains.
Oh, righto, yeah.
Yeah. So things were changing there, so we left.
Yeah.
And we heard about this place through the deer magazine, and my mates that we're heading up to see now.
Yeah.
They actually called me up and said, you know, we found another place to go.
Yeah, yeah.
And I said, I applied 2 days ago.
Oh, right.
So we all applied in the same group and got on.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. So, how big are the groups? Are they limited by number or?
Yeah, most of the groups are about four guys.
All right, yeah.
Yeah, so I think there's about 75 hunters on the property.
Yeah, yeah.
All divided into small groups.
Yeah.
Because in the deer season, you get sent to your
run.
Your
runs.
Run.
Yeah.
So you're on the run for the week with your group.
Okay. So you only get a week?
Yeah. You get, it's like Wednesday to Wednesday.
Yeah.
So Every 4 years, you'll get a run on the whole property.
Oh, right, so they rotate them around.
Yep.
Yeah, okay. I guess it's a pretty big concern. Like, there's a lot of people that say that hunting's not accessible. You know, that you can't, you just don't get, you don't get access like you used to. And now you've got to be looking out for these things to try and get the opportunity to get onto somewhere. And you hope that, the time and effort you put in once you do get on there, that they don't sell it off to someone else and then you lose access almost immediately again.
Yeah, well, that's why we left the other property.
Yeah.
Because it was being sold.
Yeah.
So the people in control of the property changed the hunter.
Yeah, right. So did they tell you you had to leave, or...?
Yeah, well, it was controlled by the ADA.
Okay.
And then they kept a couple of the ADA hunters and they kicked all the other hunters off.
Oh, right. Right, sounds a little bit political.
Very much so.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
Well, there you go.
So we're up here. If you're prepared to pay money, then you can find a good property to hunt.
Yeah.
Yeah, if you don't want to pay, it's actually very hard to find somewhere to go now.
Yeah, it is. And then, you've got, Tasmania's not so bad, I guess, but they haven't locked up everything, and it looks like maybe in the next 12 months or so they'll open up more land to hunt on if these actions that the Liberal government are putting through actually come to fruition. You know, we might have more access, which would be great, but it is a fact that getting onto hunting land, I know myself, we pretty much have letter dropped or driven into and met with, I reckon, somewhere in the realms of 200 different farms. And There's a lot of them that are locked up by different hunting groups. There's a lot of them that are just inaccessible because the farmer just either doesn't want hunters that he doesn't already know. Which, how do you get to know the farmer is the question of most hunters, I guess. Or they just don't want hunters altogether, in which case they usually have some farm management guy that has a group of mates that go on there and just cull every now and then. And that's the way they handle it, which is unfortunate because I reckon one of the untapped resources in Australia is deer meat. And we have so much deer in, you know, all, I reckon most of the states of Australia, probably bar Western Australia maybe, have ample deer to for people to, you know, provide a sustainable meat, you know, that that they can hunt themselves and break down and utilise. But at the moment, a lot of it's being wasted. So it's certainly a bit of a shame.
Yeah, well, the, I think a lot of the farmers have had such an issue with the young guys poaching.
Yeah.
That they're so scared of attracting more people onto their properties.
Yeah.
When young people realise how many deer there are there.
Yeah.
That instead of having to deal with the issues with a hunting group, they just pay the professionals to come and shoot them out.
Yeah, yeah. Yes. It's an interesting topic, poaching. So what do you think causes someone to poach?
Well, when someone's keen to shoot a deer, even for food or for a trophy, and it's so hard to possibly get on anywhere, and you don't want to go and pay $1,500 to shoot one, then they say, you know, we're sick of it, we'll go and take one anyway.
So you've bought a rifle, you've bought a scope, say, you know, what's a ballpark figure on a on like a base level scope and rifle? About $800?
Yeah.
Maybe $1,000?
Yep, $1,000.
You've got to have a vehicle. You have to have a vehicle to be able to get out there and even do something to poach.
Yep.
You've got to have a spotlight. A decent spotlight's going to set you back $150 to $200. So, and the law, I can't remember in Tassie, can they claim your vehicle? I know in Victoria they can.
I think if they catch you at a certain level, they can.
Yeah, right. So you're willing to jeopardise your vehicle or your mate's vehicle if you're stupid enough.
Yep.
All the gear you've bought, which is pretty much what you were saying, that, you know, if you went out and hunted one of these properties, you're probably going to pay $1,500.
Yep.
Something like that. But you're pretty much willing to jeopardise, you know, let's say the average kind of hunting vehicle somewhere between $5,000 and $10,000. You know, and then your hunting equipment on top of that, another $1,500, say, ish. So you could really be jeopardising, what, 7 or 8 times the amount of paying to hunt a deer? So
yeah.
You'd think from that kind of logic, might be worthwhile just saving your cash a little bit and going to pay for access.
Going to chase one.
Yeah. Without any threat of any repercussion, you know, or ending up with a 10-year ban, you know, which, you know, is obviously one of the things that results in if you get caught poaching.
Well, I think a lot of people don't think about the long-term repercussions.
Yeah.
It's sort of all short-term.
Yeah.
You know, there's a deer over there. All right, I've got my rifle here. I'm just going to go over there and take it.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, yeah. So it looks easy because in the short term I can get a deal.
Yep.
You know, and I end up with a very quick result. In which case, you know, hopefully I don't get caught and I run the risk of doing that. Yeah, it's certainly it's interesting. Do you think it's easy to poach?
I think it's a challenge.
You think it's a challenge to poach?
Because they're trying to get in there and, like, shoot a deer in an area you're not supposed to be in.
Yeah.
With a noisy rifle.
Yeah.
With people who are actually looking out for you, so they like the challenge.
Yeah, yeah. So it's something like that kind of, you know, trying to sneak one from the pub when you're 17.
Yeah. I think that's it. It's still a bit exciting, you know.
Yeah.
Looking around, you know, the adrenaline's going.
Yeah.
You run in, you're going through the middle of the night or in the afternoon or when they're going in.
It's an interesting situation because I know from, you know, I'm obviously a lot older and than a lot of these young fellas that end up getting busted poaching, and not all young fellas, but quite a few of them. When I was a kid growing up, poaching, I don't think I'd even heard the word poaching until I was, I reckon I was in my 30s. I'd never even actually heard the term poaching. And it was purely because if you wanted access to hunt back then, you know, you basically went and knocked on a door. Or you even to the point of, like, I used to trap when I was a young fella. I would just jump the farmer's fence, you know, walk to wherever I'd seen someone on the property and just give them a wave and say, is it okay if I lay some traps, you know, for some rabbits and foxes and stuff like that? And I never once got knocked back. Never once. I never even had anyone raise an issue about the fact that I was on their property, that I was, you know, obviously, you know, intending to hunt or trap something.
Yep.
There was never a question because I guess there was from both sides of the story. One from my perspective, I was there to gather something and make a little bit of cash as a young bloke, hunting and trapping. And from their perspective, I was getting rid of a feral animal, which was competing with their stock.
Yeah,
you know, and there was, I think the feeling or the intent was a little bit different as well. So the whole kind of poaching, you know, the idea of poaching is something that really, for me at least, has only cropped up in kind of the last, would say, 20 years. That and it's cropped up with a lot of other issues that are associated with it, like, you know, gaining access. I mean, you know, properties started to close down, people started to lose access, hunters started to get less and less able to hunt, and it made it much harder to hunt. A lot of the Crown land got closed down. If you remember, some years ago, they took away a lot of the Crown land access, and certainly here in Tassie. And they only left certain spots open to hunt, which were quite a distance to travel, you know.
Yeah.
I know here, if you register with forestry for hunting, which you can hunt there most of the year on forestry here in Tassie, but the closest areas to hunt are, you know, several hours away from the main, from Hobart.
Yep.
You know, you're talking about out of the sticks, which is probably an hour and a half or an hour, at least an hour and 15 before you get to an area that you can hunt.
Yep.
Then you got up at Taralia, which, again, that's...
Yeah, it's a long way away.
It's quite a way, isn't it? Yeah.
Well, I think now there's a lot more regulation. Everything's regulated so well, and the liability issues is that if something happens on a farm, all of a sudden it's the farmer's problem.
Yeah.
So they've said, look, you know, if one hunter shoots another hunter, then the farmer, who's involved as well, with the liability. So he said, it's just easier for me to not have you guys on my property.
Yeah.
And not have to worry about the liability issues.
Yeah, yeah.
So 20 or 25 years ago, that was never an issue.
Yeah.
So if an accident did happen, then, you know, it was between the people who had the accident. It wasn't between the farmer and the people as well.
Yeah. And that's right. That whole insurance issue has been something that also didn't exist kind of 20 years ago. You know, you're absolutely right. You know, the fault was with, you know, the people involved rather than the landowner.
Yeah, well, like with our boat, we took out public liability insurance.
Yep.
For a water skier behind.
Yeah, right.
Just in case a water skier came off and broke an arm or a leg.
Yeah.
We were covered, but 20 years ago, that never would have been thought about.
Yeah. It's an interesting issue, isn't it? Because, you know, the whole public liability, the growth of that kind of activity. You know, before it was just like, oh, you know, I jumped a fence and I cut myself open because I was too silly to push the wire down and the barbed wire's giving me a good old scrape, you know, and now I need stitches. Well, the question is today, who can I ping for that, you know? Which, yep. No one ever thought about that. You know, if you gave yourself a decent scrape or hurt yourself somehow, you were just like, oh, well, you know, I need to sort myself out. And you know, you get off to a hospital, get patched up, and you never really thought about it. But this whole liability thing, you know, which exists today, has certainly hindered a lot of the way we can, you know, I guess, do what we want to do as hunters.
Yeah. And I think it's completely wrong.
Yeah, me too.
That's the responsibility is with each person. It's not.
Yeah.
It's not with the insurance company, or it's not someone else's problem.
Yeah.
You need to keep your eyes open.
Yeah.
Think about what you're doing and do it safely.
Yeah, I tend to agree. I mean, you know, short of something happening because of malpractice.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
You know, but in general terms, if you're taking the risk to go out there and do it, then it should be on you.
Yeah.
You know? But unfortunately, legally, it doesn't seem to work that way.
Yeah, there's always going to be accidents.
Yeah.
That's the same in the building industry. That's why it's an accident. It's not expected to be caused, but...
Yeah, it's interesting because, I mean, even as we drive right now, we're passing all this farmland. I mean, I've approached these farms out here, these ones right that we're passing right now.
Yep.
And I got told by the guy who owns this property on the left here that he doesn't allow any hunters on here at all. And he's got, I'm looking at a big damn lake in front of us pretty much. And this thing's got ducks galore, you know, on it at any time of the year pretty much.
Yep.
And it'd be awesome, you know, to be able to hunt. And you know, I can see the ducks sitting up in the hill here right now, a good 50 or 60 of them. And it'd be great hunting, but it's inaccessible. And I'm sure that some of that is because of the reasons we've spoken about now. That, you know, they're just concerned. They're concerned about giving access. They're concerned about the reliability of the person that comes onto the property as well.
Yeah, but I've heard the same thing. You know, I've applied to go somewhere, but being put in the same box as other people that have applied to be there.
Yeah.
Who are, you know, known to be a little bit on the edges of between right and wrong.
Yeah.
So, it's to get onto these places, you've actually really got to be seen to be doing the right thing all the time.
Yeah.
And as soon as you get kicked off one place for doing the wrong thing,
yeah,
word gets around very quickly, and it can be very hard to get back on somewhere else.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. Well, the property that myself and the kids hunt on now, which, you know, we were speaking a little while back, and I was telling you on the side there whereabouts it is, and that's a really decent patch of land. It's got deer on it. It's got, you know, plenty of wallabies and some decent size, kind of almost a halfway between a forester or eastern grey and a wallaby. So some big ones on there, but not quite the size of what we call a forester down here. You know, plenty of possum shooting. You know, you could shoot there every weekend. That's great. We're the only ones on there.
Yeah.
And we have been the only ones on there for about 6 or 7 years, other than very infrequent friends and family, you know.
Yeah.
And I'm talking, you know, very close friends to the farm owner. And we've taken a number of people on there, and he has no issue with that, as long as we let him know. But he's not interested in letting anyone else have access.
Yep.
And he said it to me a number of times. He said, it's too much hassle. He knows us. He knows what we do. We built a little range there, and like a 100 and 200 meter range and everything. And he uses that himself, and he loves it. But he's just not interested in the hassle of having other people access the farm. Which is kind of strange too, because, you know, he's rang me up on a number of different occasions where he's said to me, hey, can you and the kids come out and actually do some culling? He said, you know,
yeah. Yeah.
And so the flip side of it is that they need people because it's not cheap to hunt. I mean, if you buying bullets and shooting regularly, you know, it actually can rack up an expense quite quickly.
Yes.
You know.
Yeah.
And so the flip side is the whole conservation thing that they need to be able to grow, these animals, which are generally sent off to be butchered for meat, whatever. And they're competing with, you know, a lot of these either feral or other animals that they want culled off that area.
The old kangaroo, it'll keep breeding according to how much food it has.
Yeah.
So as soon as the farmer's fertilising his paddocks and growing grass and growing crops for the sheep to feed on,
yeah,
and there's a lot of feed, then it'll have a lot more just wallabies and kangaroos naturally breeding.
Yeah.
Because of the food supply. So
yeah.
Unless the hunters actually keep the population under control, then all of his hard work is basically going to be wiped out by the wallabies.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, we've seen it firsthand. I mean, he runs a number of crops on there as well.
Yep.
And it's interesting because the wallabies tend to eat from the outside in. They sit on the fringe of the crop areas when the crops sit at about, you know, 5-6 inches, and they just kind of nail this circular area around the outside of the paddock that was square ends up becoming this circle. You know, where the wallabies are eating the fringe of the paddock. And where the funny thing is with the fallow deer, the fallow deer just eat straight through. So there's been several years where we've seen, you know, a mob of 30 or 40 fallow, and there's almost a line, like a stripe, straight through the middle of a couple of the crop fields where the fallow have just eaten straight through it. You know, and you've got this kind of circular effect from the wallaby. So, but you know, it doesn't take them long either. They can certainly smash a paddock in a very short amount of time.
Yeah, I used to work for the forestry in the regeneration side. We would go to the beach coop every 2 weeks, and it was just amazing how much damage could be done on the outside.
Yeah.
From the possums and from the wallabies in just 2 weeks.
Yeah.
Moving the area, especially when the trees are freshly planted.
Yeah, it's an interesting one, that's for sure. There's so much land, I mean, you know, and there's so much land that you could hunt, which would be really cool to hunt. I mean, I've as I said before, you know, I've gone to a number of properties and knocked on the doors and I've left even letters and stuff like that. And there's been times that we've driven through areas where we've seen deer roaming freely, you know, but they're just inaccessible. So hopefully, you know, the future of it will be that, you know, with the growth of the next generation of hunting, I guess, and an inbuilt responsibility and education around what has to happen, you know, that starts to change. But in the short term, I think we're going to be fighting that kind of poaching / accessibility battle, you know, for quite a while. So changing tact a little bit. You've hunted a few different animals, but obviously we live in Tassie. And fallow is kind of the deer that we have that's accessible here. But if there were one animal to hunt that you reckon would be the king of what you could hunt, what would it be?
I think probably the hardest animal to hunt to get a really good head in Australia is the Samba.
Samba deer.
Because the country that they live in.
Yeah.
Like we've been over to Victoria chasing them a couple of times.
Yeah.
And father-in-law and I dropped off a ridge, and it took us an hour to descend about 400 metres.
Yeah.
Straight down into a gully, and then we got to the gully, and there was a creek in the gully, and the other side was just as steep. And we just sort of climbed our way around the hills. And it, the country that they live in is just in the high, like in the actual proper high country. It's so hard to get near a really good stag that when you actually get onto a good one, it's, yeah, a lot of guys spend 20 years in the same sort of spots trying to chase them.
Yeah.
Yeah, a deer that's very high on my list at the moment is to try and shoot a big sambar.
Yep, over the 30 inch.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep, in the backcountry.
Yep.
Somewhere out the back of nowhere, like in their habitat
where they're living.
Yep. Walk in, spend a few days.
Yeah.
Walk around, try to find them.
Yeah.
Because they're, when the scrub's so thick, you can bust them and they can be right in front of you.
Yeah, yeah.
So, yeah, it's really, really hard deer to actually hunt.
Yeah. They're a deer that can put the wind up your toe. I mean, I've been barked a few times. And, you know, by sambar.
Mm.
And, man, it raises the hair on the back of your neck.
Yeah, well,
when you don't expect that they're there.
On that trip, I was chasing a hind up the other side of this gully, and I reckon she honked me about 10 times.
Yeah?
Because the bush was so thick, and she would move 5 or 6 metres. And then I'd move up close, and she didn't know what I was, and I couldn't see her.
Yeah.
And we just kept chasing each other up the hill, up and up and up.
Yep.
Just so thick that neither of us could actually pick each other out until she got right on the top of the hill.
Yeah, right. And she spotted you.
Yeah, and then she finally saw what I was, but she'd only been moving such a short distance.
Yeah.
And then having a honk.
Yep.
And then moving and honking, and it was, that was fantastic.
Yeah, yeah. Makes for an exciting hunt.
Yeah, really exciting. Because they're so big and they honk so loud.
Yeah.
But,
yeah. They're, I'm the same. I haven't gotten it. I've not even shot a male stag, like a sambar stag, so
yep.
At this stage. So, but you know, on the list for sure. So that'd be your number one. When do you think you'll next get a chance to have a ping at him?
I'm hoping next year.
Yeah.
You got to be so fit and so like dedicated to get a big sambar. Yeah, in the high country.
Yeah, yeah. So at this stage, that's your favourite animal? Be your favourite animal to hunt?
Yeah, I think so. I've had some really good hunts. I really, really enjoyed hunting my red that I got. Like,
yeah.
I shot him about after 4.5 days of hunting and, like, turning them down.
Yeah.
And I had a really good stalk on another really good red. And
yeah.
Then in the end, you just kept moving up the hill. Just
yeah.
Kept moving up further and further, and I kept stalking him. And then he just crest over the hill. And then a day and a half later, one of my mates that I was with shot him. And they turn up, and they're like, we were looking for fallow. And he said, this red just came over the hill, and he was just too good to leave.
Yeah, yeah.
So they called us on the radio, and we came back and had a look. And then Craig said, I reckon that's that red that we saw that you were chasing. And I'm like, is that deer for sure?
Yeah.
He was just even and big absolutely everywhere.
Yeah.
All
yeah.
The points were this long and they were all there and they were all perfectly shaped.
Like, yeah, yeah. Nice big crowns.
Yep.
Or royals. Yeah.
And but the you know, just having the memories of the stalk from those stalks even hunting, even though we didn't shoot him.
Yeah.
That's you know, that's what stays with you.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
And that's
yeah.
Why I like having trophy on the wall because I look at big fallow I've got on the wall.
Yeah.
I think yep on that trip we you know we chased and we shot that chittle.
Yeah.
And then we had a bit more time so we went out and we found this fallow and we shot him.
Like, yeah, yeah.
It's just lucky that we got him.
Yeah. Yeah, there's a lot to it, isn't there? So like, you know, that whole trophy on the wall thing which you mentioned, that I mean obviously, you know, I've got a one or two of those in my house too, so it raises different emotions amongst different people, but for the hunter, the whole, like from certainly from my perspective, similar to you. It's for me, it's more about the fact that it's a level of respect that, you know, it's the memory associated with that respect, and it's the fact that the enjoyment that I had out of not killing the animal as such, but certainly in hunting the animal and then succeeding in that hunt, you know, that, you know, when that memory comes back and you sit there and you see that, and you go, wow, that was great. That was an awesome day. You know, it was, I mean, I have the, you know, you've seen one of the fellows on my wall, the one I shot in New Zealand, and we were hunting red deer, and we've been chasing red deer for 5 or 6 days, free range property, you know, so it is what it is. You either get it or you don't. And there's no guarantee, you know, because they're completely free range. And I had passed up the opportunity to shoot. And it's, you know, this happens quite a bit, you know, where you go out and you're dedicated to hunt something, and something else turns up, which you weren't expecting to shoot. But it puts that question in your head of, man, that looks like a really good animal, you know. Should I hunt it and shoot it?
Yeah.
And you know, this was kind of the last 15 minutes of the last hour of the last day. I hadn't got a red deer. We'd had a few opportunities, been busted, you know, and unfortunately it was now pretty much 15 minutes before last light. But for nearly 3 hours on the ridgeline opposite us, we'd been watching this one paddle of a fallow sitting out from the bush on the side of this kind of semi-ridge cliff face thing, you know, leading into a bluff. And we could only see one antler, and he was continually walking towards us. You know, it had gotten to that point where I'd actually said to my young fellow was with me, and I said, "Nah, I'm not going to shoot. We shoot fallow all the time. I'm definitely not shooting a fallow when I can only see one antler. Yep. You know, there's no way. It's just that whole thing that, you know, I've seen too many broken antlers. I've seen too many, and fallow fight. Yeah. When they fight, they fight,
yep.
And they rip themselves to bits, and they break antlers, and they smash palms, and you know, all this kind of stuff. So I was like, no, I'm not shooting that, coming all the way to New Zealand, and if I don't see the other side, I'm not shooting it.
Yeah.
So it's bloody dark, or practically dark. I can see him in the scope. I've got him lined up. No red deer, so I'm thinking, if I see that other antler, I'll take a ping at him. He's, you know, nearly 300-odd metres away. And sure enough, just as we were about to call it quits, he turns, and I see the other antler, and that's when I let the shot go. And dropped him. And it's that memory, it's that moment that when I see the trophy on the wall, every time I can almost, I sit there and I relive it. You know, it's like, yeah. Wow, that was, I wasn't expecting it. It wasn't something I was hunting. It was purely opportunistic. And we were in the right place at the right time. And I got myself an awesome fallow, you know, an absolute fantastic free range fallow. And he's an old war beast, you know.
Yeah.
You know, rounded tips and, you know, all that kind of stuff. All these points are, you know, big, long brow tines, like massive, big, long brow tines on him. And, you know, it's just, you could sit there and, I could talk about it for an hour, you know, that one hunt. And, for me, he's sitting on my wall as a place of respect. Yeah, it's an interesting thing. But like I said, it raises a lot of emotions amongst a lot of people.
It really does.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yep.
I've had a few people walk into our house and it's almost like they put their head down. Yeah.
Don't quite know where to look.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. Well, I think it's like a lot of things. It's the way, you know, it can be the way you're brought up.
Yeah.
And a lot of this can be about how you think about things.
It's,
you know, you eat a piece of meat from here or a piece of meat from the end of the day, it's they all come from the same place.
Yeah.
But it's, yeah, people have a lot of issues because they can't get around the fact that they can actually see, you know, the form of the animal that it was that they just ate.
Yeah. It's a funny thing too because, you know, like I grew up, you know, kind of semi-associated with the farming industry, and with family members all working on farms or owning farms. You know, grandfather and even my own dad at stages, you know, running sheep and cattle and whatever else. And when you live in it like that, there's a steeled expectation that these animals are going to die.
Mm,
yep. You know, you're not growing them for them to live. You're growing them for them to die.
Yep.
And it's not out of disrespect that that's happening. It's purely out of the requirement that people need to eat. But what's been removed from that process is the whole sight thing. You know, people don't see it anymore. It's a long way away. It's what they see is a polystyrene pack.
Yep.
And which, you know, disassociates any of the idea that something died, you know.
Yep.
You know, even now I've noticed with, you know, the butcher shops, there's a couple of butcher shops in town where now they kind of, they don't even have carcasses in view anymore, you know. At where you used to go to a butcher shop and all that stuff was pretty much hanging straight behind the butcher.
Yeah, and you could take a cut that you requested at the time.
Yeah.
People are very detached from where their food comes from.
Yeah.
Because now the city is so far from the country, so the country's over there and the city's here.
Yeah.
And we don't want the two to mix.
Yeah.
See, my dad grew up on a farm, you know, in northern Tassie.
Yeah.
So what you're talking about there is, it's just part of life.
Yeah.
It's how it is. They always had a, you know, like a steer that they raised by hand.
Yeah.
From a calf, so they could actually keep it in the yard around the house. And that was always intended at a certain age. It would, you know, fill the freezer.
Yeah.
And then they would hand raise another calf.
Yeah.
To be able to feed it. To then, you know, become next year's dinner.
Yeah, and quite often they were called freezer fillers.
Yes. You know? And that was the whole purpose of the animal.
Yeah.
It was, you know, it was looked after like a family pet around the house. But that was always the intention for it to feed the family for the next year.
Yeah. Well, even when he hit the freezer, he was still around the house.
Yeah. He's still in the freezer. Yeah. But that's what you did. Like, you know, they didn't have excess money to just go down to the shop and buy food, so you grew your vegetables and you butchered your meat and you did what you could to survive.
Yeah, there's a whole interesting tweak to that too, talking about vegetables, because I've had a number of vegans, you know, that have, and vegetarians that have had a go, you know, about hunting and either hunting for meat or for trophy, doesn't seem to matter. They hate them both. And you know, but I do crop protection. I do crop protection on the farm that we hunt on now, you know.
Yep.
And that crop protection is for, there's three paddocks full of vegetables, you know. So where are those veggies going?
Well, that's where we're headed tonight.
Yeah.
We're headed to do some crop protection on a couple of very high-value pivots.
Yep.
That have irrigations actually put the crops in.
Yep.
Which are at a very vulnerable stage. So they've said, we need help, we need protection for this, you know.
Yep.
For the crops that have been planted there. So without us doing what we've got to do, there won't be any veggies and there won't be any crops.
Yep. So the whole idea that vegetarians and vegans don't actually kill anything, well, they may not actually pull a trigger ever.
Yep.
But in order for their food to survive, animals are dying.
Well, there's, yeah. Unless the animals are controlled, there's no lettuce and there's no carrots. And there's no... All these crops that get planted, all the fruit trees, everything.
Yeah.
Without us protecting them, it can't happen.
Yeah. Yeah, I've said it to them, and they, a lot of the time they look back in shock, like, you know, what? How can you say that I've caused an animal, you know, to die? And it's like, well, food doesn't come for free for anything. It requires land, for starters. The animals were living on that land before it were crops.
Yep.
And now you need it as a resource to grow your food. And
but you can't plant a field of potatoes unless you cut the trees down that were on that field.
Yeah.
And you shoot the kangaroos that were on the field.
Yeah. Yep. Your vegan meal's going to be very light on.
You have to grow it yourself.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, on your rooftop terrace.
Yeah, it's just the reality of it. There's... We're not out here trying to be cruel or trying to be inhumane. We're here to do a job.
Yeah.
And that it actually helps everyone in the long run.
Yeah. It doesn't take away the aspect. I enjoy hunting. I'm not going to steer away from that. I actually do enjoy it. I do it because I enjoy it. I've always enjoyed it. I've enjoyed being a part of it. For me, some of it's about the chase, some of it's about the reward at the end, some of it's about the food as well. I much prefer having my freezer. You know, this year on several different occasions we went on big meat hunts, one of those we brought back 203 kilos. And I love that. I love the fact that we have our own meat, you know.
Yep.
We make our own mince, we make our own sausages, we have our own steak. You know, I don't want to have to buy it all the time, and I don't want to have to feed the factory farm mechanism. You know, if they want to do that, that's fine. But I'm not against it at all. But I'd much prefer to get my own meat.
Yeah. Yep. Yeah, well, me too. And I enjoy fishing.
Same
thing. Enjoy fishing. We go out, we catch a feed, we eat them, we put them in the freezer, and then we eat the fish. It's the same thing, really, for me. And I enjoy the hunting, and that's why we're out here as well.
Yeah.
Job that needs doing, and we can actually enjoy doing it and enjoy spending time together doing it. So.
Yeah, exactly. You were saying before you enjoy hunting and everything else like that. How'd you actually get into hunting?
I hadn't actually ever shot a deer before I started dating Lauren.
Yeah.
I first started, hunting wallabies and rabbits and possums.
Thanks for grabbing me a coffee, by the way.
Oh, thanks. Sorry, I'll grab that after work on the way around.
Good work.
Well, I first started hunting when I was about 14.
Yeah.
Chasing the wallabies around.
Yeah.
I just had an air rifle. And then chase them around. And then go and stay with a mate. And his dad said, here you go, here's my lever action 22.
Yeah.
I live next door to a farm. He said, you guys go over there. Here's a packet of bullets. Spotlight. Be careful.
Yeah.
And that's how we started.
Yeah.
So we'd been around a bit, and we were just collecting the wallabies, and we'd end up cutting their back leg and then hanging them on our belt.
Yeah, right.
We'd walk around with half a dozen wallabies hanging off us, and then we come back and we clean them, and it was all meat for his dog.
Yeah, yeah.
So that's how we started, and then when I met Lauren, her family was in deer hunting a lot.
Yeah.
So I started, going more hunting with them more and more.
Yeah.
And then shot a few deer with them, and then it's just gone from there.
Yeah, right.
So they were filling cull tags.
Yeah.
Same thing, doing crop protection with the deer in on the property they were on.
Yeah.
Which had, you know, completely overrun with deer.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
So they were taking a lot of deer every year off these properties, trying to get the deer away from the property so they can still grow the sheep. Yeah, so that's how I started to get into the stalking and hunting, and then the passion for it just built from there.
Yep. So this question you might have already answered in some way, but when I asked before about your favourite thing to hunt, which you said was sambar deer, but if money was no option whatsoever, and you could hunt anything in the world next week,
yep,
without any problem whatsoever, and your missus ain't going to say no, you can't hunt, you can't go, Nath, you know. And we all know that's a negotiation for all of us, you know. But everything's right. It's all good. You can hunt whatever you want next week, and you've got the money to do it, whatever the cost is. What would you hunt?
I don't know. I'd hunt a lot.
Maybe specify it's only one animal. You get the chance to hunt one thing.
Yeah. Oh, I'd love to shoot a bear.
A bear.
I'd love to shoot a big brown bear.
Yeah.
Just huge, but...
Yeah, it's something that's an interesting one for me too, because bear's one of my dream hunts.
Yeah.
It's always been, for me, I'm actually quite specific with bear. I'm glad you said bear, because for me, it's always been a bear from Kamchatka in Russia. Yeah. A big Kamchatkan brown bear. And I don't know why, I've seen them years ago. They're obviously ridiculously expensive to hunt. You've got to get to Russia, which for us means you've got to submit your passport for like 45 days to the Russian embassy or something like that.
And it's dangerous, and it's hard, it's a challenge.
Yeah.
So it would be very exciting.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah, I agree. Yep. Man after my own heart. Bear hunting.
A lot of the aspects that I enjoy about hunting is that it is such a challenge, and you put in so much work.
Yeah.
And so much effort and so much preparation and money and time and everything to actually end up harvesting an animal at the end.
Yeah.
So, I've got a couple of fallow on the wall, and I've got very strong memories about my small fallow, and I've got very strong memories about my large fallow.
Yeah.
And it's not about the size; it's about that one. That was the first deer, the first stag I ever shot.
Yeah.
So Craig and I went up for three or four full weekends and hunted Friday night, Saturday night, Sunday, like the whole weekend, every minute we could.
Yep.
And then right at the very end, after looking at everything, we finally found this deer. And then we said, yep, that's the one.
Yeah.
And it's, it's not just a quick, there he is next to the road bank, take that.
Yeah.
It's all the effort that's actually gone in between, now and then.
Yeah, absolutely. There is a lot that goes into it, which is another interesting kind of semi-topic. And that's actually about shooting or actually shooting the rifle. Because at the end of it all, once you've done all that hunting and whatever else, you've gotten to a point where that you want to, where you have the opportunity to kill a deer or finalize the hunt, you got to fire the rifle and you got to shoot straight to actually get it. There's an element of hunting, I think, that it's questionable with a lot of hunters how much time they put in to actually shooting their rifle.
Yep.
And I mean, with us, obviously Hunt Shack running an agency, we've seen people turn up to hunt and like this is the second time they've shot that rifle this year, kind of thing. Yep. And you sit there and you're just wondering how well is this gonna go, that time factor that you were talking about, I think that one of the things that if you're hunting and you're hunting seriously, one of the things that takes a lot of time is actually getting and being comfortable with your rifle.
and definitely, especially with the larger calibers.
Yeah.
Because you've got to deal with the recoil, you've got to deal with yourself, you've got to deal with your flinching, and your emotions when you're there about to shoot the animal as well.
Mm.
So we've always spent a lot of time, you know, developing the hand loads and trying different loads and trying different shells. And then once you find one that works, actually spend a lot of time shooting the rifles to actually to be comfortable, to know that when you're laying down looking through the scope of the deer, the last thing you have to worry about is your actual, can you hit it?
The tool.
And is it going to shoot straight?
Yeah.
All you've got to think about is, right, I've got to get myself in position and I've got to hold myself straight. Like,
yeah.
You've got to, and it's one thing that Craig said to me a lot, he said, look, just keep shooting and shooting and shooting your gun until you're 100% confident.
Yeah.
He said, you know, you've got to be in yourself. He said, if you're not confident that your gun's going to hit the same spot every time, he said, you'll never hit anything.
Yeah.
So he said, you don't want to be there. He said, you know, if you move your scope or whatever, just get back on the range and just put more shots down the range just to get that confidence up. Once you've got your confidence, then you don't have to worry about the rifle.
Yeah. Yeah, and one of the reasons why I mention it is because, you know, it wasn't such a problem, or it hasn't been such a problem in the past with everyone kind of, you know, most people were kind of happy to shoot something that was, 50, 100, 150 metres away. And if you're using anything around that kind of 30 cal mark,
yep,
those kind of distances don't matter.
No.
They really don't matter. But as soon as you start pushing out, you know, the 200 mark, you know,
yep,
and the 250, all of a sudden things change quite dramatically, you know.
And it matters where you actually hit the animal.
Exactly, yeah. In order to make a shot that dispatches or kills the animal quickly.
Yes.
Yeah. And nowadays you seem like, I don't know whether it's just me, or I certainly think that there's a bit of an industry push around this as well about distance shooting and people's capability to shoot long distances. And as much as, like, you know, we've bought for this trip in the morning, you know, we're going to have a couple of pings out of my Ruger Precision rifle. And it's a rifle set up for long range shooting. You know, not really hunting because it's too bloody heavy, but if you can sit on a hill somewhere, a grassy knoll, and knock off a presidential kangaroo, you know, then you know you can do it at a distance with an RPR. There's no problem with that, and not intentionally trying to piss take on a tragedy, but it is a bloody good rifle for long distance shooting. But there's a whole heap of factors that are a part of shooting distances. And it's something I believe requires a fair bit of practice and a lot of knowledge and understanding as well. You can't just, you know, because you think that you can shoot 100 metres and pinhole a piece of paper, putting that out at 400 metres is a whole different box of dice.
It really is. And that's why we've always been more focused on spot and stalk style hunting.
Yeah.
So we'll sit back on the hill or in the bush and, you know, glass the whole valley or glass the hillside, glass everywhere, and then see, you know, that deer over there, he looks like a good deer.
Yeah.
We'll put the stalk in, you know, we'll get within 150, 200 metres of him, and we'll have a look and we'll assess it. We'll see if we want to take that deer or not.
Yeah, yeah.
Because we're well within the killing range.
Yeah.
And we can be, you know, we can be as sure as you can be to have a confident shot to actually get the job done.
Yeah, it's certainly a big change because the optics and stuff that we have around today, you know, even your binos and stuff, I mean, they're so much better than
they're
what
amazing.
They ever were.
Yeah.
Swarovski,
you know, binos.
Yeah.
You can range something out to 1,300. Meters,
yeah,
every time,
yeah,
and you can see it because they're so clear.
Yeah, it's amazing the changes in those types of things, and you know, with all of the technology that's around today, has certainly made a big difference. But that doesn't increase your skill. And this is where I think there's the kind of the missing link, is that because I've got this kind of, you know, $2,500 pair of binos, and I've got, you know, this $3,000 scope, and I've got a hunting rifle, which, you know, whatever brand has told me is, you know, can shoot out to a kilometre, you know, all of a sudden, then I must have the skill because I've got all the gear, you know. But the skill is something that has to be honed as well.
Yep, but the guys shooting at the long ranges, they're at the range and they're shooting hundreds and thousands of rounds to actually be able to do that.
Yeah.
Like, you know, efficiently.
Yep.
Because it's no good if you can hit one down the range and then you can hit 10 over there and then a random one here and a random one there. But
yeah.
My Seiko, it can just, it's just got legs. It can just go and go and go, but
yeah,
it'll outshoot me every single time.
Yeah.
Those sort of ranges.
It's, there's a lot more people that are sitting around today that feel that their skill level is probably beyond the reality of what it should be. So you talked about your Seiko. You reckon is that your favourite rifle? If you had a favourite, what is it?
Yeah, my Seiko 223 would be my favourite rifle that I've got.
Yeah.
Because it, with the hand loads, it'll shoot the same spot every single time.
Yeah.
You know, round after round after round. So when you miss one, guys are like, you know, that was a terrible shot. And you're like, it was a terrible shot.
I agree.
Because it's such a good quality rifle. That once we actually did get, it took us a little while to get the right loads for it.
Yeah.
So, some cases it doesn't like, it'll shoot them all over the place.
Yeah, and right.
Some factory loads, you know, you can't hit the same, you shoot 6 inches apart every second shot.
Wow.
But then once we actually started hand loading for it, and we found the right case and the right projectile, it'll shoot as well as you can hold it, really good.
Yeah.
It's fantastic.
What scope have you got on that rifle?
I've just got a Leupold VX4, I think, is on it. Yeah, it'd be a 3-12, just a little one, but
yeah.
After I'll put the Swarovski scope on the 300, and after looking through that, then it's makes me want to upgrade the scope on the 223.
It's a constant problem, isn't it?
Yep. Yeah, I've got the Z6 on the 300, so I keep thinking about swapping that over to the 223.
Yeah.
Just because we use it so much. And the light is just picks up everything.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, as we were saying before, the change in the technology in these things has just been amazing. I mean, I've got a couple of... in fact, I've got the first scope I ever owned. It's an old metal Nikko Sterling scope that was on a 22 Magnum or a... it was a 222, I think.
Yep.
That I was hunting with when I was a kid hunting foxes. And I remember when... I'm pretty sure it was my dad that bought it for me, and I was amazed. I was like, wow, this is awesome, you know.
Yeah.
You felt like some kind of military sniper. And nowadays it's just commonplace. I mean, practically no one shoots iron sights anymore.
The first air rifle that I had a scope on it, and the diameter on the scope is about as big as your finger.
Yeah.
It's a really long tube with a tiny little sight.
Yeah, yeah.
And we were absolutely wrapped with it.
Yeah, yeah. All right, well, we've pretty much arrived at the property now, so we're going to go hunting, and we'll catch up with everyone later.
We hope you enjoyed podcast one, the first one ever, with I Am Hunter, and we look forward to providing many more with hopefully better soundtrack quality than what we got out of that drive. Anyway, thanks, guys, for listening. We hope to bring you many more good conversations. Cheers, guys.